Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to coast, This Week in America. It's true. The United States Air Force gave a 17-year-old West Virginia hillbilly, a high school dropout, a battery of aptitude tests and determined that he could be a tin man. And it wasn't easy. Only 7 graduated from air traffic control school out of 22. After a year of intense training at a high traffic control tower, Stephen Morris became a tin man, an air traffic control tower who can move heavy air traffic safely and expeditiously. After 27 years as a tin man, Stephen became the director of a Fortune 100 company and a senior vice president at the fourth largest integrated facility management company in the U.S. However, his biggest lifetime achievement will always be his time as a tin man. When he retired from the United States Air Force in 1984, he took over a former FAA control tower on Cape Cod, one of the hundreds of facilities the FAA-PATCO union walked out of and were fired by President Reagan. Tall Tales from the Tower is a peek into the control towers, radar, air traffic facilities at airports all around the world, with true stories of recovering lost aircraft, emergencies, safely landing 17 fighters in severe thunderstorms, and air traffic control in a war zone. Stephen enjoys traveling now with his wife throughout the United States and Europe, enjoys American history, Civil War buff, interest in politics, and current events. Stephen Morris, author of Tall Tales from the Tower, The Real Hillbilly Elegy, is our guest on This Week in America. Stephen, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's great being with you.
I am looking forward to this. What a great book that you've written. Time in an Air Traffic Control Tower. I just look at what you people do and marvel at the talents that you have. And we'll talk about it during the program. But let's go back to the beginning of this. When did you decide to write the book? What was the inspiration to write Tall Towers from the Tower?
Well, I initially wrote a couple of true air traffic control stories and shared it with my friends. And one of my friends, my last boss in the Air Force, who's also an author, encouraged me to write the book and put all my experiences in the book. He thought it would be interesting to folks. And of course, when I was in air traffic control, a lot of people asked me questions about what is air traffic control, what did you do, and what are the different types of facilities and positions within the facilities. And so I got to thinking, well, you know, I'm a retired senior master surgeon, and most military memoirs are written by colonels and generals. So I said, why not a memoir about air traffic control, my experience? Since we senior master surgeons are the backbone of the Air Force, so my friend Bill Gunnan, who is a retired pilot, checked out on 16 different types of aircraft.
Wow.
He's also an author that wrote Secret and Dangerous, the night of the Santoy raid, POW raid. So he helped me as I went through it and would review things for me. And so he was a big help and encouragement. And that's basically why I wrote the book.
The book by Stephen Morris is Tall Tales from the Tower, The Real Hillbilly Elegy. His website, Stephen's website, is talltalesfromthetower.com. Easy to remember, title of the book. Book available at Amazon, all of the usual places. So much to talk about, and you make us feel we're right there with you during the career. You had opportunities during the successful Air Force career to be a controller at an FAA tower, considerably more money. Why didn't you do that?
Well, you know, it's true. Back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the FAA made considerably more money as controllers than Air Force controllers. And the reason I stayed in the Air Force. Is in 1964, my supervisor, we came to work on a afternoon or swing shift, and he handed me a book and said, "You really should read this." And the name of the book was None Dare Call It Treason. And it was written by John Stormer and sold about 7 million copies. It was a compilation of facts from hundreds of congressional investigations and authoritative books on the communist socialist attempts to infiltrate the U.S. government and our major institutions. And I would say that if you read the book today, I think you would see a lot of parallels as to what's happening in the world today.
Interesting. And that kept you in the Air Force. And we'll talk about this career. And I want to talk later about the difference between the two. You've got a great explanation of it's two totally different skill sets to be an air traffic controller for the FAA and the U.S. Air Force. When we talk about air traffic control, we hear a lot about the pressure that's on you. Did you experience that pressure? Did you feel that pressure?
Yes, I did on occasion. I would say if I look back at my 27 years in air traffic control, it was probably maybe 10 to 15% of the time. I think anybody that works heavy traffic will feel a little bit of pressure. For example, recovering 17 fighters in severe thunderstorms in Louisiana, I had 17 of those fighters on individual radar vectors around the thunderstorms. I had the thunderstorms ghosted in on the radar. And so to keep up with 17 fighters, to make sure that I had required separation and that I remembered their headings. And my assistant controller was very good. He kept the altitude straight as far as the aircraft I had. I finally got a hole about 20 miles from the airport and was able to hand one at a time over to the arrival controller. I had to be very, very conscious of the fact that these fighters were making precision radar approaches, and as such, they had to be on separate frequencies, discrete frequencies. So I had to make sure that I didn't have two aircraft on the same frequency, because the precision radar controller, he talks them down, and he only unkeys his mic maybe for 3 or 4 seconds. And so that was a challenge. Plus, I had to make sure that in trail separation was at least 5 miles, because when they reduced the final approach speed at about 5 miles final, there was compression, and you would end up if you had 5 miles separation with the minimum separation of 3 miles. So, that was a little bit of pressure. I upheld the controller code, though. I made sure they didn't see me or hear me sweat.
I'm sure that's a key, and it has to be difficult to do as you're in a situation like that. 17 different planes, a number of lives represented by those 17, in a perilous situation. Are you aware of the gravity of what you're doing, or are you just able to funnel vision it through and just focus on getting them down to the ground?
I think, you know, most controllers, they don't think about the gravity of the situation. They're just looking and saying, how do I get these guys on the ground safely? And so that's their whole concentration. I better turn this guy to 320. Need to descend this guy to 3,000. So, you know, that's sort of the picture, of course, changes every second. So you had to keep up with it. So just the actual controlling and getting the aircraft in position to land safely was the main concern. And so I guess you could think about the gravity of the situation after they were safely on the ground.
So. I was going to say, is there a moment when like 17 is safely on the ground where you do a wow and just sort of sit back and realize what you just did successfully? Is there a moment afterwards when it hits you?
Well, I think, you know, when I pulled away from this position after they were all down, I thanked my assistant controller who kept up with the strips, their flight progress strips that are on a board. And he was really good in keeping the strips in sequence, as well as on some of the aircraft, he actually had the last given heading of the aircraft and, of course, the altitude. So that was a big help. And if he hadn't been there, I don't know. I would have really had a tough time. So I was able to reference the strips on the strip board to make sure I had my mind on the right sequence and the right aircraft. And if I needed to double check a call sign of an aircraft, I could do that.
Yes. So, Stephen Morris, our guest on the program. The book is Tall Tales from the Tower. Book available at Amazon, the usual places. Stephen's website, talltalesfromthetower.com. You talk when you transfer into a new air traffic control facility. You get involved in something called getting checked out. I guess that's like a facility rating for that facility. What exactly is that?
Well, sir, that's I don't think most controllers look forward to that. But when you transfer to a new facility, you have to get what is called a facility rating. And that entails three parts. Part one is memorizing the airfield as far as runways, runway headings, dimensions as far as width and length, navigational aids that may be on the airfield, all of the taxiways, their identification and location. You actually draw that out. And so also you need to draw out all of the instrument approach procedures into the airport, as well as the instrument departure procedures from the airport. And so that is really a challenge because you memorize those, and that includes, you know, minimum altitudes, the radial for the final approach, the final approach fix, the decision height, and so and the weather minima for the approach. So if you have 10 or 11 instrument approaches into an airport, which is not uncommon, as well as five or six departures, then you have to draw all of those from memory. So I would say that for me, when you get there, you get a facility rating manual, which has all of that information in it, all the frequencies of the facility as far as radio frequencies of the nav aid and the nav aid identification and so forth. So you draw that out and you write all of that out, and it will take, in my case, maybe I'm a slow writer, but it took 8 to 9 hours to,
wow,
to put that on paper from memory.
That's an amazing what goes into this. It's no such thing as a simple transfer then, is there? You have to totally relearn the new facility.
No, there isn't. The whole airspace, of course, when you transfer is different. The only thing that remains the same is pretty much phraseology.
Yeah.
Is the same. The separation criteria is the same, but as far as airways and airspace dimensions and handoff procedures and that sort of thing, those are specific to that facility. And so that is part one, which was to me the toughest. Part two is a 5-hour or 6-hour grilling by the FAA examiner on all of the facility memoranda, the operations letters, letters of agreement. They will ask you about emergency procedures for specific types of emergencies. And so that is quite extensive. And then part three, the last part of the rating, involves working live traffic with the FAA examiner plugged in with you as you work traffic for 4 or 5 hours. And if you get through that, okay, you get facility rating.
Wow, what an amazing story. That and so much more in Stephen's book, Tall Tale from the Tower, The Real Hillbilly Elegy. Stephen Morris is the author. Our guest is website, talltalesfromthetower.com. Book available Amazon, wherever books are sold. When you were at the U.S. Air Force headquarters for air traffic control, you were responsible for the withdrawal of air traffic controllers from the career field. What was involved? How many controllers were withdrawn?
Well, we, the years I was there, which was 77 to 80, we withdrew 900 air traffic controllers from the career field, and we canceled their air traffic control specialist certificates. And the reason, probably the primary reason, was failure to obtain a facility rating. And so, but also, we had withdrawal packages that would come in. And by the way, I initially reviewed them, and then I distributed copies to legal at headquarters as well as personnel, which in the civilian world is HR, but to make sure that the package was complete and thorough. So we also had people withdrawn for drug and alcohol abuse. Controllers back in my day were checked unannounced for drugs frequently. And so we had alcohol abuse, drug abuse withdrawals. We also had some controllers at a point in time would write a fear of controlling letter where they said, I just can't do it anymore. I have a fear of air traffic control. And we didn't question that at all. So that was another reason. And there was a fourth reason that was called a character and behavior disorder, where the supervisor would document behaviors that were not normal. And so yes, those are the primary four reasons that a controller would have his certificate withdrawn.
Well, the time is going by so quickly. Stephen Morris, our guest on the program, his book, Tall Tales from the Tower. Just briefly here, how long can you be in the tower? How long can you, the shift go before you've got to take a break? How many hours?
Well, we had, of course, hourly restrictions that were pretty much established by the FAA. So actually, in a week's period, we could not work more than 40 hours. So there was a limit on 40 hours a week. And so most of the shifts that I had in the Air Force, and I set up a similar shift schedule for the control tower on Cape Cod, is you start your round swing, which is 5 to midnight, afternoon, noon to five, morning, seven to noon, and then midnight, you come back at midnight and work 12 to 7 a.m. And so over, and then you go on break. And so you get the rest of the day off after you get off this mid shift and the next day. And then you come to work the following day at 5 o'clock in the evening. So we made sure we adhered to that. And,
yes.
And so that was the limitations. We also had limitations. You could not have an alcoholic drink 8 hours before you went on duty. So that was monitored very closely by supervisors.
It's just fascinating, the pressure and dealing with the pressure and being on top of your game, because literally lives depend on it. We talked about the example of the 17 aircraft in a storm that you had to land. Are there other, a couple examples of aircraft emergencies that, that you controlled? I know you had many, but maybe a couple that stick out.
Sure. Well, there was one. It was not that difficult. There was, I was in Thailand at Tok Le, which is was a major American air base during the Vietnam War. And I had an A-37, a Thai A-37, touched down and the gear collapsed and he started skidding down the runway. And I noticed that his aft fuselage was on fire. So I notified both the pilot and co-pilot. Now, the pilot and co-pilot in an A-37, they sit side by side. So each of those, the co-pilot and the pilot, put their leg over the side of the aircraft and rode it like that.
Wow.
Until it came to a stop, and then they jumped and started running, and almost immediately the aircraft burst into flames. So that was one that wasn't, you know, I mean, it's sort of routine. But I had another one that's quite dramatic. I was working in the Azores, Portugal, Lodges Field, which is a big American air base in the Azores. Now, the Azores is a nine-island archipelago, and Lodges is on Terceira Island, and the that island is 900 miles west of Lisbon and 2,200 miles east of New York City in the North Atlantic. And it's not so critical maybe today, but certainly in the 50s and 60s when we had a lot of prop-driven aircraft, they would stop there and refuel when they were going to Europe. So I'm working precision radar in the radar approach control at Lodges in the Azores, and I hear the approach controller pick up a Piper Comanche, of all things, 50 miles north, emergency fuel, and she requested the run. Let me explain. The runway in use was to landing and takeoff to the northwest because the wind was out of the northwest. But she requested an opposite direction landing because of her critical fuel status. And so she, the arrival controller set up his surveillance because I was working precision radar. My radar was set up on runway 33. Just the opposite direction of the way she wanted to land because of a critical fuel. So he set up a surveillance approach radar and started dropping her down, stepping her down. And at 1 mile, which was the minimum decision height, she didn't have the runway or approach lights in sight because the weather was about 700-800 foot ceiling with maybe less than a mild disability. So I'm saying, wow, this is bad. So she had to go around. I told the arrival controller, I said, give her runway heading, which was 150, and I'll pick her up on the departure end or the approach end of 33, and I'll take it from there. So I said, have her maintain 1,000 feet. So he did. I picked her up at the approach end of 33. Of course, she was flying the opposite direction. And at about a mile and a half, I gave her a right 90-degree turn to heading of 240. Then, right before she went off the precision radar, I gave her a left 270-degree turn to a heading of 330, the runway heading. And she rolled out slightly right of course and slightly above glide path at about 3 miles. So I talked her down. She landed, turned off at the first taxiway, and the engine quit. She was out of fuel. That was
wow.
Close.
That was very close. Such amazing stories. And you'll find these and so much more in Stephen's book, Tall Tales from the Tower. A couple minutes left in the program. I just want to talk about locations. You were actually stationed several during your career. Do you have a favorite? If someone could say, you want to go back and work there, would you pick one?
Well, yeah, I really liked Aviano, Italy, Northern Italy. I mean, I liked the area. The food was great. We got to travel a lot. In fact, back when Yugoslavia was a communist country, we took a tour of Yugoslavia from Aviano, Italy, and we also made friends with Austrian controllers. Air traffic controllers in Austria, and they were great because we would visit on two or three times, and they took us to places the tourists never got to see.
Oh, yes.
And so that was a great experience, the food, the travel. And so, yeah, I would say that was great. And in the U.S., it would be Alexandria, Louisiana, because I really enjoyed the Cajun culture. So that was a nice assignment. Although I was a very, very busy guy there, but when I could get out, we enjoyed it.
Do you miss it?
Oh, sure, I do at times. I guess when I first got out in 87, I really missed it. But, you know, over time, it fades some. And so, but I still think about it and think about, you know, back in the day when I could shake them and bake them. But,
I can't believe you're too far from that. As you're going through telling these stories, it's like you're right back there living the moment. And that the stories come alive. The book is Tall Tales from the Tower, The Real Hillbilly Elegy, by this book by Stephen Morris. What's the connection between J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, and your book?
Well, this is... Well, J.D. Vance wrote a good book. I read the book. However, he violated the hillbilly code of conduct by throwing his mother and his grandparents under the bus. I mean, he flat said, hey, well, you know, my family, my mother and my grandfather and grandmother, they were drunks and drug addicts and... My mom ran around with a bunch of men. I mean, a real hillbilly. First of all, he was born in Middletown, Ohio. And so he cannot claim that title of being
a hillbilly.
No,
I know where Middletown, Ohio is. That's not hillbilly heaven there, I'll tell you that.
That's right. So anyway, I thought, now my wife, her family, now she was born, by the way, in Middletown also. So her family is from the same place in Kentucky, Jackson County. So she is really upset with what he did as far as his parents. And I just heard recently that J.D. Vance's mother just now has forgiven him for what he put in the book. Wow. So anyway, and let me add just one thing. J.D. Vance, of course, is an attorney, a Yale graduate attorney. And I would say to J.D., that's great, J.D., you were certainly a success. But let me tell you, most air traffic controllers that I knew, they would consider themselves a couple levels above a Yale attorney.
Interesting. I'm going to have to look up Hillbilly Code of Ethics after we Google it, after we finish the program today.
But it's true. You don't air your family's dirty laundry.
That is true. That's fascinating. I got about 30 seconds here. How are you doing in retirement? It sounds like you're having a ball, especially going back and telling these stories.
Well, I'm doing okay. My wife, I'm a full-time caregiver. She has a lot of health problems, but she's doing okay.
Good.
We get to, of course, spend now a lot of time together. So we get to, talk about a lot of things, and we like to watch documentaries on the History Channel. And
yes.
I especially like to watch air disasters on the Smithsonian Channel.
Oh, they do an excellent job with those, yes.
I'm sure. So anyway, we're doing good. We read and talk, and even though we're sort of housebound, we're doing okay. You know, we talk about the good old days.
Well, and they are. And I'm so grateful that you were able to spend some time with us today. I love the stories, and hopefully we'll do this again. Tall Tales from the Tower, The Real Hillbilly Elegy by Stephen Morris. His website is talltalesfromthetower.com, name of the book available at Amazon, the usual places. Stephen, a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. It was great. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick, for having me. I really appreciate it, and I've really enjoyed talking with you.
It has been our pleasure. The book Tall Tales from the Tower, Stephen Morris, the author and our guest. Information on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Back on today's program after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.